Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. Charlotte might have to spend more than $110 million on soccer, but they want some guarantees. Another stunner from the Panthers. Luke Kuechly announces his retirement. The General Assembly fails to vote on overturning Governor Cooper's budget veto, so teachers will have to wait a little longer for a raise. And CMS locks down the school this week just days after they announced their crisis alert system doesn't work. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and seated around this table are David Borax, reporter for WFAE News. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Annie Ma is here from the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Joe Bruno reports for WSOC TV Channel 9, Eyewitness News.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Joe. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and contributor to WCCB TV. Morning.
Morning.
We're all here on the radio. You can watch us on Facebook Live. Charlotte City Council held its annual retreat in the high resort town of Durham. Mecklenburg County is going to hold theirs in the high resort campus of CPCC. Why Durham?
They do this every year. They leave town. They want to get away from distractions. I will say, compared to, this is my fourth or fifth Charlotte City Council retreat, and this one felt like they actually accomplished a lot and they got a lot out of going away.
So you were there.
Yes.
Were you allowed to get into the actual meetings, into the discussions,
yes,
and watch that?
Yes.
And you wrote that at these retreats, council members get to outline their goals for the year. How structured is this process?
It felt more structured this year. It was less conceptual than years past. There was a lot less team-building exercises and more, let's get into the nitty-gritty and figure out what we're going to do for the rest of the year. So there was a facilitator, and there were different topics each couple of hours that council took deep dives into.
And council members spent time talking about affordable housing, all the usual suspects of the budget, transportation, other things. But let's begin with soccer. Council talked about the $110 million commitment to Major League Soccer for the first time publicly. But I wouldn't call this publicly. My God, they were in Durham, for crying out loud. But it was the first time they discussed it in open session.
Correct.
And they did this on the third day, not the first, the third day of the retreat. So does the ranking in order of importance tell us anything?
Well, this was certainly the most important topic. It was the most newsworthy one.
Saving the best for last, I think.
Saving the best for last, yes. We finally got a look at the Charlotte Convention Center Tax Fund, you know, the fund that will actually go toward this project. And the senior city staffers that made this presentation to council basically said, listen, you guys have plenty of money. You'll be able to afford this $110 million. We just need guidance over what projects you want to see prioritized going forward in the future. But the fund is very healthy. It's a minimal hit when they spread that debt out over 20 years, and they are in a good position with that fund, even if a recession does come.
I'm going to come back to that.
Sure.
Because that kind of actually shocked me. The city's chief financial officer said we can, quote, absolutely, quote, afford to spend $100 million on a tourism-related project, but Tracy Dotson added a proviso.
I need to know that Tipper's not going to go to South Carolina. I mean, the goal is that we're making an investment in MLS that's also making an investment in keeping the Carolina Panthers here.
Is that the first time we've heard that this money's going to be tied to a commitment to keep the Panthers in North Carolina, specifically in Charlotte, as opposed to moving it to Rock Hill?
Yeah, and that was my question that she was responding to, because I was basically asking, why does the new stadium have to be a part of this $110 million? What do you want to know from Mr. Tepper? And that was her response, that the tether is expiring very soon, mm-hmm, and the city wants to get these talks locked down, and they want to know what Tepper is thinking, whether it's a dome on Bank of America Stadium or a brand new facility somewhere in Charlotte. And so that is the focus of those talks. And they want to know that before they hand Tepper a check for $110 million.
And that check would be for soccer, not for football.
Correct.
It would be for upfitting the stadium and some other infrastructure projects surrounding the acquisition of soccer.
Right. And as you've been saying on this program many times, I think it is a very safe assumption that tax dollars will go toward whatever Mr. Tepper has planned for the future stadium.
So this money would would come from the Convention Center Tax Fund. Is this the same thing as the tourism fund from restaurants and hotels and things like that?
There are two different tourism funds, but yes, this is composed of the prepared food and beverage tax and the hotel motel tax.
Okay. And Dotson said that we could absolutely afford to spend $100 million. There's $10 million missing out of that figure from what we allegedly have promised soccer. Why?
They were trying to be cute, I think, in the presentation and present council with a hypothetical $100 million project scenario. But come on, we all know what they were talking about.
And she also said, Tracy Dotson, the city's chief financial officer, that the amount of the investment might change as we discover how much David Tepper is relying on public dollars to cover the cost of upgrades at the stadium. What does that mean? Above $110 million?
I think they were alluding to the fact about the new stadium, that more tax dollars could go toward that.
And David Tepper, let me ask, is David Tepper likely to make a commitment to keep the Panthers here, given that we know he's going to be asking for money to build a new stadium? We know this. It's coming down the pike. It will happen.
I think absolutely that Tepper wants to keep the Panthers in Charlotte, but I also know that he has options. He can go to Rock Hill if he wants to.
Right. So this is the first, and he said that, essentially, yes. Particularly about soccer. He said, if you don't play ball with me, I'll just take it to Rock Hill.
Right.
This was the official first public discussion of this money being used for soccer, and they have to talk about this publicly by law. But the money was kind of already committed before the public discussion. When will the actual public, citizens of Charlotte, be able to chime in on this?
And we asked the mayor that, and it sounds like it will be a rolling basis. What they're kind of pushing right now is this rezoning petition that will be filed this month for Eastland Mall. That will kind of kick off the public engagement on soccer in general, because there's going to have to be a community meeting involving the East Charlotte neighbors who live near Eastland. And then there will be a public hearing probably around April on the project itself, where anybody can sign up to talk about it, and then the vote will come sometime in the early summer.
What struck me about the conversations at the retreat, and I was not there, so I'm watching from afar, but is just how thin that commitment was in terms of details. I mean, it makes it clear that the city and David Tepper and everybody involved wanted to make sure we got the MLS here. So a number was thrown out, and it satisfied the MLS, and we had our big announcement. But we are still waiting for the details on this.
So MLS is only one thing they talked about, and I want to move to those other things. But first, a little into the weeds here. The city's chief financial officer, Kelly Flannery, told council that they have an estimated, and I know numbers are hard on the radio, but try to follow this. The city has an estimated $41.7 million in the Convention Center tax fund, from which this $110 million is going to come. But the balance is projected to be in that fund, $101.9 by 2024 to $500 million in 2044. And he used this analogy of paying a mortgage over 30 years. That makes it affordable. You're making monthly payments on this $110 million. Does that mean that we're going to be borrowing money for upgrades for a stadium that's not going to be here in 10 or 20 years? In other words, we'll still be paying off a debt for a stadium upfit when we've already demolished that stadium and moved on to another one? I mean, you can't do that with a house, can you?
No, you can't. I do believe that's how it sounds, but I'm not sure if those details have been worked out exactly just yet, but that is an absolutely good question.
I think that's bad. Wait till we get to CMS. Go ahead.
I'm just saying, also, so many of the details about Eastland Mall redevelopment, right, and the entertainment complex, there was so much talked about when the announcement was made, but they really haven't really locked down a lot of those details as well.
Right, and that's before that $110 million is transferred, that's the first priority. They got to get Eastland taken care of. Then they want to know the plans for the old and the new stadium. And then they're going to talk to Tepper about this entertainment district.
Okay. So what happens if the city says no or comes in with a much lower figure? What happens?
I don't even know if that's a scenario worth considering now.
On Monday, they also talked about other things, including affordable housing, and Mayor Lyle says that she'd like to focus on home ownership, not just on rental units. What does she mean by that?
She means, there's a lot of, you know, the whole focus is about rental units, building apartments that you can get people into, but you're not building wealth. You're not owning the home. You don't have control over your destiny, and home ownership helps fight against gentrification and all sorts of things. So that's what the mayor wants to do, is kind of shift that conversation, especially when we're talking about this $50 million affordable housing bond that'll be on the ballot in 2020. The mayor wants to look at land banking, especially in parts of West Charlotte or along the Freedom Drive corridor, so that the city can get more people in the homes that they actually own.
They also talked about the budget. Evidently, they're projecting a $6.8 million?
Yes.
$6.8 million deficit between what we are going to bring in and what we need to spend. Is that normal at this point in the process?
The city says it's normal, and the city isn't concerned. Ed Driggs isn't concerned right now.
He's not concerned. We should not be concerned. He's the money guy.
Last year, the city was able to save about $12 million by making some cuts here and there. And, of course, we didn't have a property tax increase last year, and the city is not projecting at this moment that we'll need a property tax increase. The problem is the $6.8 million gap, the big contributor to that is police pay, and the city has made policing and the pay in Charlotte a lot better. There's more incentives to be a police officer now because they're earning more.
And yet when they talked about public safety, which is police, there was this revelation from CMPD that the department can't keep the department fully staffed. 65 officers retired last year, 47 resigned. There are currently 182 openings. That sounds like a lot to me.
It is a lot.
Is this a matter of our not paying enough, or simply that a lot of people simply don't want to be police officers in this environment
anymore? I think that the environment still is a little difficult for people to go into law enforcement. There's that perception there. And so the city is putting a large focus on still recruiting officers. Councilman Braxton Winston mentioned that, you know, when we have all these officers in town for the RNC, we should be having job fairs and trying to poach some of these lateral officers. I'm not sure if other departments are excited about sending their officers to Charlotte now, but that's just one idea that was tossed out there.
We'll be having CMPD Chief Kerputney on the program on Tuesday to talk more about that and other things. Transportation was a point of discussion. You report, Joe, that the bus system in its current state did not receive a ringing endorsement
No.
from members of council. At-large member Braxton Winston said, quote, "It's lacking, it's not dependable." And yet, he also proposed the city make the bus system free.
Right.
How did that go over?
I think it was tossed out there as a long-term goal, but I mean, I think the major focus right now is Envision My Ride and cutting down on that 90-minute average trip time, which is kind of crazy to think about. But a lot of money is needed just to implement that.
Kansas City, Missouri did it. You going to tell
me? I was just going to say, this is something that Kansas City, Missouri is trying right now, and it's an idea to boost readership and to solve one of the basic problems that people have. If they have to live farther away from where they work, how do we get them there? And so it's something that Braxton Winston wants to push this term, but I'm not sure the money is there right now.
Well, it goes hand in hand with affordable housing, because more and more people have to be so far out to be able to afford a home, and so how do they get to the work?
The Kansas City, it's costing Kansas City taxpayers $9 million to make the bus system there free. I don't know how we compare in size to Kansas City, but Assistant City Manager and Chief Planning Director Taiwo Jayoba recently said the cost of making buses free here would be prohibitive. We would lose $27 million in fares, which doesn't even pay the majority of the cost. So is this a non-starter here?
It seems like it, okay. But it will be discussed.
Has Braxton Winston, for that matter, given John Lewis, the CEO of Katz, a chance to do what he's trying to do, which is make it more efficient?
Mr. Lewis was at the meeting, and yes, that was brought up.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about what he says we need, and we'll also get into this new plan to demolish Discovery Place.
Yeah.
That was a shocker this morning when I picked up the newspaper. Impeachment wasn't nearly featured on the front page as much as that and Clayton Wilcox, which we'll also get to in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup with David Borax, Joe Bruno, Mary C. Curtis, and we will hear from Annie Ma, I promise you, in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We have gathered around our table Annie Maw from the Charlotte Observer, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV. Joe Bruno is with WSOC-TV. He's been talking a lot because he covered. He was actually at the city council retreat, which was this week in Durham. And David Borax is here from WFAE News. So one of the things that they got into was the idea of making the bus system free, and it probably won't happen because it would be just prohibitively expensive. But CAT's CEO, as you mentioned, John Lewis, was at the retreat, and he says that the system needs an additional $32 million for operational costs and fuel, plus they need to buy 100 more buses. Now, they'd need $50 million to buy diesel buses, $75 million for hybrid buses, and $100 million or more for electric buses. But the federal government covers 80% of the cost of electric buses. Are they the front runner?
A lot of council members certainly want electric buses, yeah. But it's important to note this is in reference to the Envision My Ride program, which would allow people to be picked up by buses every 15 minutes. So that's why an additional 100 buses are needed, and that $32 million annually.
Every 15 minutes
costs.
Throughout the day?
Every 15 minutes throughout the day. And that's what they want. This is the program they want to put in place to cut down on that 90-minute average ride time.
Well, you don't want to buy diesel buses for that because that will really increase air pollution.
And fuel costs.
They're really, the hybrid buses have been what's been proposed as a compromise here, but a lot of council members really want to start going towards electric, and other cities across North and South Carolina are going that route too. We're also putting them in at the airport.
Okay.
I just want to throw out here that, remember, the city council also has some big climate goals in the Strategic Energy Action Plan. Mm-hmm. If they do not do electric buses, they don't meet their goals.
So, this morning, I prepared all the city council retreat stuff last night and didn't know anything about this until I picked up the newspaper. And the Observer the ink does not come off on your finger, so I know it to be true. The Observer reports this morning that a full demolition is one of the two scenarios Charlotte is exploring to reboot Discovery Place, which was built in 1981. They're already taking down the library beginning next year, right across the street. Why do we need a full demolition of this place?
I asked Mayor Vi Lyles that, and she said if we got to build or tear down to build what's best, we'll do it. But basically, the Discovery Place is the number one museum and cultural attraction in Charlotte. It is very important for our workforce and for STEM education. Field trips are there every single day. And right now, the city and Discovery Place are engaged in this master planning process to figure out how to best position the museum for the future and how to compete against other museums across the world like the Franklin Institute in Philly.
And Tracy Dotson, who's the Assistant City Manager and Economic Development Director, said there could be a less drastic effort, which would involve rehabbing the existing, an entire rehab of the existing facility. Didn't we just do that?
Well, in 2010, they provided about $31 million toward renovations. But
it was 10 years ago.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And it'll be 15 before any of this
happens. In 2017,
the
city paid $700,000 for a study to figure out what the best case scenario is. And the two options that have been presented now that they're considering is one, the full demolition and rebuild, and two is the renovations.
So somebody made mention of a good fact, and that is that this museum was built. When was it built originally?
1981.
For the population of our region in 1981. It has exploded since then. So the building really can't handle it. So if they took the building down, did they know what they would do in the interim?
No. That's a very good point. We don't know how long it would be out of commission. But some of the changes that need to be made, the entrance is very confusing. There's so many different ways to get around the building. They need more hands-on labs. And even the IMAX theater has to be upgraded because they're still using film. And that limits the amount of movies you could show.
And, of course, there's the question about what they're going to do with Discovery Place, the Nature Museum, which is over there near Freedom Park in a neighborhood that has become tonified. It's very Tony over there now.
Tonified.
It's the Beverly Hills of Charlotte. Let's be honest about this. And they don't like all that traffic coming through. They don't want to expand that museum in their neighborhood. I don't blame them.
Yes. Yeah, so what are they going to do? Not an easy time to work for Discovery Place right now.
Could they build it all together in one place?
Some people are pushing to put that Nature Museum in Park Road Park. Yeah, but I mean, that. It's just like, it's very tough. They planned for so long to put that where in Freedom Park, and they have all these renderings and things. So I can see how the process would be significantly delayed if they have to pick up everything and find somewhere else to put it, even if it is Park Road Park.
So moving on, the Panthers are losing a superstar this week. 28-year-old Luke Kuechly announced his retirement.
You know, there's only one way to play this game since I was a little kid is to play fast and play physical and play strong. And at this point, I don't know if I'm able to do that anymore. And that's the part that is the most difficult.
Gets a little choked up there. That's audio from the video that he made about his retirement for the fans and others. He didn't say why he reached this decision, just that it was difficult and that it was the right thing to do and now's the right time to do it. Has anything leaked out about this decision?
Well, he was beloved as a player and as a person, too. I mean, he was an all-star. He's only one of four defensive players in the 2010s to make all-pro first team at least five times. But the New York Times had an interesting piece that he joins the NFL's under-30 retirees club, like Colts quarterback Andrew Luck and Rob Gronkowski of the Patriots, and a lot of them saying, you know, long-term health over short-term success. He also had missed 7 games because of concussions between 2015 and 2017.
Do we think he's doing this to protect himself or because he's still suffering the effects of the concussions that he's already received?
Well, I don't know. I can't, step in and say.
So nothing's leaked out.
Right. No, but nothing's leaked out. But at the same time, people can see this. Alex Boone, who was an offensive lineman in the NFL, looked at that picture of him in that New Orleans game in 2016 when he was carted off the field like crying. And he said, you know, when he had his concussion, he said it was like hitting the reset button on your brain, and he cried for 2 days straight. So
become irrationally emotional because of those injuries.
Yes. Yes, and fans were very supportive, and other NFL players were as well. Yeah. So the whole culture of playing through the pain that used to be exalted, people are taking a look at that, particularly now with all we know. So I am not speaking for him, and of course it hasn't leaked out, but it was obvious that he still loves the game. As he said, I still want to play, but I don't think it's the right decision. Well,
you mentioned that he was choked up during that. It was hard to watch that and not get choked up yourself, no matter what you think about football or the game or him. It was just a wrenching video to watch. You know, he has been through concussion protocol so many times in recent years. I think, you know, you're 28 years old. You've made a lot of money in your career. You've had a lot of fun. The only thing you see ahead is how tough the game is. As Mary just mentioned, you know, it's not an easy game. And that week in, week out struggle to make yourself get up for the games has got to be something that you think about. I think the idea of retiring on top is something we all should think about.
And he has a future. I mean, he has very popular ads.
There you go, Mike.
You know, he's very popular pitch person. He could be a coach, a commentator. He's known for playing the position really smart.
Yes, what happens to those CPI commercials? Come on. Junk all those CPI commercials.
Well, he's also, and I see him all the time. I think he's in my neighborhood. You see him at the post office at the Harris Teeter or the Boston Provisions.
I see him at restaurants a lot.
Yeah.
And I want to say something, but I don't.
Well, I don't, but when people do, my husband just saw him at the post office. He was trying to do some business, and this woman just wouldn't leave him alone, and he was so nice. So he's been here his entire career, and so there was a sense, I think, in Charlotte, it was like, oh my goodness, you could feel the shock and a little bit of the sadness.
I just don't think you can blame him for making the decision that he did.
No.
Absolutely. And I think that I agree with Mary that he has so many options. He could be an analyst. He could be a coach. And I do think he will be in the Hall of Fame. But keep this in mind, like just the amount of changes that is going to happen with the Panthers between last year and this year. No Ron Rivera, no Luke Kuechly. Greg Olsen might retire, and we don't know if Cam Newton will be quarterback.
Well, speaking of Cam, NFL Network insider Ian Rappaport says it appears Cam is less and less likely to remain a Panther, and he predicted that Newton would be traded in March. But in the meantime, fans have been paying for a Keep Cam in Carolina billboard campaign, which winds down on Sunday, but we will always have the campaign's jingle.
We gon' keep Cam in Carolina. We gon' keep Cam in Carolina. Let's go. Tampa is clever. I believe he would never let Cam Newton lead the Panthers. Ain't no quarterback better. All this talk about cap space and 19 mil.
but you can't put a price on a human highlight reel.
Okay.
Wow.
That's enough of that.
Let that play a long time.
One thing to add, Newton is a first-time nominee for the nationwide Walter Payton Man of the Year Award, given every year to an NFL player for his excellence on and off the field with a significant positive impact on his community. And he has certainly been involved in philanthropic efforts in this community for years. And he received more than 600,000 votes, winning first place from the fans in this charity challenge, which allows fans to vote for their favorite players. Is that a lot of votes, 600,000 votes?
Yeah, I don't think the second place finisher came close.
Okay. It's a lot, it seems to me, for somebody who only played two games last season.
Barely
but he does
qualified.
Great work. He does great
right.
work
he
in the community.
He does in the community. The Panthers really have such a record of that. Isn't Thomas Davis a former winner of the Walter Payton Award?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, and so, people do, you know, the kids love him, and he's another one who's been synonymous with Carolina Panthers, and he took him to the Super Bowl. He was the MVP, so there's a lot of feelings about him. But football decisions are business decisions.
That's right. And I just want to point out before we move on to other topics that Luke Kuechly is walking away in the next 2 years for more money than all of us will make in our lifetimes collectively.
Correct.
That's true. Yeah.
Well earned, though, if you had to play every week.
All right, let's move on to something that was a really big surprise this morning. On the front page. This was the headline on the front page of The Observer, and it eclipsed the impeachment. What a surprise. The FBI has investigated CMS, and they came into the process evidently after the eviction of former Superintendent Clayton Wilcox. What's up with that, Annie?
Well, we don't know. Excuse me. We don't know too much about it. The former school board chair, Mary McRae, and the current school board chair, Elise Dashew, told us that they were contacted by the FBI after Wilcox left and that the FBI was interested in documents from the district. They issued a federal summons and CMS complied with it. Neither of them knew exactly what the documents were, but they told us that they generally were looking into whether federal funds had been misused in the district. The district was told by investigators that it was a routine thing done after public officials leave office.
Did they do it after Heath Morrison?
I wasn't here at the time, so I don't know.
Okay. Does anybody know?
I don't remember a story like that.
No, neither do I. And I'm wondering why this story came out at all and why it came out now.
I can't speak to why, but we called them yesterday and they answered our questions.
Because Mary McRae, the former school board member who left office in December, said that the FBI contacted CMS, as you just said, but that the board was kept out of the conversations between the FBI and CMS in case it would have to take later action on any related issues. Huh? The board was not involved in an FBI investigation?
Yeah, and I think what Mary said is that, you know, the board is the oversight committee for CMS, and so any disciplinary decisions, any action that's taken because of the way things are structured in North Carolina with, like, local education boards, they would have to decide, and so they were kept out of these conversations to make that delineation clear.
So we don't know, or we do know, that this was Clayton Wilcox focused.
We know that it happened after Wilcox left, and it came in the wake of his departure, but the board members weren't really able to be specific.
The Charlotte Observer did try to contact Clayton Wilcox for a comment on this. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we reached him by phone, but he referred comment to his lawyer.
What does that tell you?
His lawyer told us that they were not aware of these contacts, that this was something that happened after he left, and that was the statement she gave us.
So meanwhile, this week, CMS superintendent, the new superintendent, Ernest Winston, announced another problem at CMS on the heels of the technology snafu that we talked about last week involving the much maligned new $200,000 CMS website, which is now no more. They took it down because people hated it after spending all that money on it. And it was, a project of Mr. Wilcox, I don't know. Ernest Winston announced another, more costly, more serious problem involving the much-touted school security system, which the district rolled out in August.
At school after school, we found that the system didn't perform as promised, and it did not perform consistently. In other words, we had a system that did not work well all of the time and didn't work at all some of the time.
You can fill some of the people all of the time. The system was commissioned in the aftermath of that fatal shooting at Butler High in 2018, and banished Superintendent Clayton Wilcox told parents, faculty, staff, and students that this new $1.75 million system from a company called, is it Centegix?
Centegix is what I've been saying.
C-E-N-T-E-G-I-X, would make everyone safer. Well, they put that in when? In August? And we're just finding out now that it doesn't work. Why?
Well, I can't speak to the technical issues, but the way the system works is that teachers, staff, I believe everyone who works for CMS are issued these like panic cards. And mm-hmm. if they have a button on them, you're supposed to wear them behind your ID. And if you click the buttons a certain way, it's supposed to set off an alarm system of lights and track the teacher. It was very high tech at the press conference where they rolled it out.
Are we the only system in the country that Centegix has designed the system like this for?
No, they are in other school districts.
Do they work there?
I don't know. I haven't seen reporting to that thread.
So the Observer asked questions of Centegix in writing at the company's request. The company said, you want to ask us questions, put them in writing. At last report, you haven't received a response. The paper also raised questions about oversight of this project, but Ernest Winston seemed to wave that concern away.
You may ask me, whose fault is this? And the answer is, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter? Not a good choice of words. Is this just another in a series of blunders by CMS? Why did he say that?
I honestly have no clue. I cannot speculate on his or the district's thinking, but we've been asking them questions about this project for months now, and they called that press conference last week.
So if everybody around this table recalls, that system was coaxed. The system was coaxed the school system was coaxed into using reading instruction. I guess it was a computerized reading instruction system that teachers and some administrators said we didn't need, and that the one we were using, in fact, was better than the one that Clayton Wilcox wanted to put in place. But Wilcox insisted, and yes, then he purchased it. Is this another instance of that?
We found in our reporting, we went through Wilcox's calendar, his phone logs, and he had a lot of contact with the founder of the company.
Which goes against rules at CMS,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, best practices in CMS are that when you're bidding on a project, as when you're dealing with bids, that you don't want to talk to the founders of the company. Oh. Because
To the founders of the company. Somebody has to talk to somebody.
Yeah, so there's like very structured channels for those communications, and talking privately with the superintendent is not one of them.
We have more to say about that and many other things before this program ends at the top of the hour, and we'll come back with more in a moment as Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. 2020 is going to be jam-packed for North Carolina, a presidential battleground, a pivotal Senate race, elections for Congress and legislature after lengthy court fights over gerrymandering, and, of course, this summer's Republican convention in Charlotte. Through this election year, join Charlotte Talks every Monday for an in-depth look at politics. Listen Monday mornings at 9 on 90.7 WFAE and on the Charlotte Talks podcast. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE and on our Charlotte Talks podcast. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call on WCCB-TV, Joe Bruno from WSSC-TV News, David Borax from WFAE News, and Annie Ma, reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And we're talking about this story that came out this week about the system that was put in place at CMS during Clayton Wilcox's tenure that would allow teachers and faculty and staff to alert the front office to a problem in case of a shooter on campus or some other problem. And it doesn't work. It's a $1.75 million system that apparently doesn't work. And we were just talking about some rules being broken between Clayton Wilcox and the founder of the company. His phone logs indicate that he had conversations with the founder of the company. And that kind of goes against regulations set up to make sure that the money situation and the purchase of products and services is done on the up and up. It turns out that Wilcox's wife is a Facebook friend of the founder of that company's wife. So that kind of muddies the waters. The school board oversees how money is spent. And they did not vote to approve this $1.75 million purchase, which was equipment and things like that. It was all done through purchase orders, which don't have to go through the school board. Isn't that a lot of money to go through purchase orders and not through the governing body with a contract?
It is. And school finance researchers and experts we talked to were kind of stunned that it was done this way. But this is something that they told us, is that sometimes when you're trying to avoid oversight, you will route things through purchase orders. Now, I don't know if that was done in the CMS case, but that is what a lot of people kind of pointed out to us, because that way, when things don't rise to the threshold of needing a vote, you can kind of get around it by splitting it into
So we don't have a contract with this.
Don't have a contract with them.
Will they fix this?
Or
will they walk away? You bought it, it's yours.
That's a great question. And one of the reasons that people told us that you normally always have a contract is when things go wrong, you have something to enforce. So Ernest Winston, the current superintendent, on Friday said he was going to give the company 30 days to fix it, a deadline of February 10th. Otherwise, they're going to try to get their money back. I'm not quite sure what exactly that looks like, because there's no guideline for what they were supposed to deliver. So it leaves a lot of questions for what's
next.
So
this indicates to me that the school board has given superintendent or former superintendents a cash flow of $1.75 million of discretionary money to spend. Would that be accurate? Because that's what he did. He spent $1.75 million through purchase orders without having to go to the board.
Or the question is, where did this money come from?
Where did it come from?
I believe the money came from the county. State funds are pretty regulated, but the county did give CMS money for security projects last year. And some of it was certain projects where, like, when they built Charlotte East Language Academy, this was, I believe, funded through bond money because it was considered a construction project. So I believe most of the money did come from the county. And next week, the county and CMS are having a joint meeting, and this is one of the agenda items. So I'm interested to see what they're going to say there.
So what has the school board had to say about all this?
I have not heard anything from them. We're going to keep reporting and keep calling them, so that might change in the future.
Well, the Observer article that I read said the Observer made a request for an interview with school board chair Elise Dashew. That was refused. She was vice chair when the system was put into place, and then Chair Mary McCray did not return your calls.
Yes.
The school board is opaque and shouldn't be, and they should be held accountable for this, period. Let's move on. Leisha Shockley, because I'm done with them. Leisha Shockley, a teacher at Selwyn Elementary, a 2014 CMS Teacher of the Year, who was temporarily removed from her classroom, I think toward the end of last year, has been reassigned. Now, why?
Well, so she has been moved to a central office position. The district says they can't tell us that much about personnel reasons, but I think that if you're going to take a teacher out of a classroom but put her back in a different classroom, that raises questions about why she can't go back to the classroom that she was in, and so putting her in central office sort of takes away those pressure points.
So in the interest of full disclosure, Leisha Shockley is a member of WFAE's Community Advisory Board. She has been the subject of complaints, or had been subject of complaints, I think, by more than one parent, but the feature parent in all this was Mecklenburg County Commissioner Tariq Bakari.
He's a city council.
Excuse me. Tariq Bakari, who says that he did not apply any extraordinary pressure to make this happen. He just reported what he thought was abuse of his child in her classroom. She was initially suspended with pay, and then they put her in another job. Given how closed-lipped CMS is about this and other personnel actions, are we ever likely to find out anything more about this?
It seems like they're trying to move on from this. They're not really talking about why this happened. I know that parents at Selwyn Elementary, both in the classroom and in other classrooms, are extremely frustrated with the way that things have been handled. Their class, the class that Ms. Shockley was teaching, has had just a rotating array of substitutes, and they've told really sad stories about how their kids are struggling to process this. But they are very frustrated with the lack of clarity. They understand you can't talk about confidentiality. personnel reasons, but they feel like just even things like, when are we going to get a teacher? What is the process like? What's going to happen? What recourse is there? They feel like those questions haven't been answered.
So teachers across the state were hoping for a raise this week, I think, because they thought that the school board, not the school board, the General Assembly, would vote to override the governor's veto of the budget. The House has already voted to override that, but the Senate did not. Why not?
They simply don't have the votes. The leader of the Senate held a press conference before the session the other day, and he said, we're not going to be able to do this. He put it on the agenda anyway, but in the end, they were not able to do it.
Well, it's a Republican-controlled Senate, so why don't they have the votes?
They need at least one Democrat to vote with them to overturn the veto, and the Democrats in their own press conferences have said, we're going to stand together on this one.
And Senate Leader Phil Berger says the budget is being held up. He said this many times in the past, being held up over Governor Cooper's insistence on Medicaid expansion. That's something a lot of Republican legislatures are now changing their mind about and moving toward, just not ours. But outside of expansion, the state was scheduled to make massive changes to the way it administers the current Medicaid program for nearly 2.2 million low-income adults, children, pregnant women, the elderly, and people with disabilities. And without this budget, plan changes to how Medicaid pays health care providers seems to be up in the air. So what happens now to folks on Medicare as this budget stays stalled in the legislature?
Well, we'll be sticking with the current system for now. And the way it works is, right now it's called a fee-for-service program, and this is reporting by my colleague Claire Donnelly, by the way. And they would pay, in a change of the system, they would pay into a managed care system, which would in turn pay doctors. So instead of paying doctors directly. And the idea is this would improve care. We will stay where we are for now until this is worked out. There's also the larger issue of expanding Medicaid, which is holding up the budget as well. So,
okay. Yeah, as you said, we were one of 14 states that decided not to take advantage of the Medicaid expansion, and some much redder states now are changing their minds on this.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting, too, in terms of the teacher raises, that NCAA, the biggest state's teachers association, has also embraced Medicare as one of their issues. They're trying for like a whole approach to making education more robust in the state, and the health of their staff and kids through Medicaid expansion is something they're advocating for, too.
And meanwhile, Governor Cooper was in town this week. He was at CPCC, and he's called on the General Assembly to expand grants for students at community colleges and universities who find themselves with acute financial difficulties. He proposes to give students up to $1,000 a semester for a maximum of two semesters, which can cover things like rent, car repairs, expenses, or books. That would total about $20 million. Is this likely to fall on deaf ears in the legislature?
The way negotiations have been going lately, I think that would be a reasonable assumption.
Okay. Wells Fargo reports profits are down, at least they were in the fourth quarter, $1.6 billion from a year ago. And the bank's new CEO, Charlie Scharf, says the bank needs to cut costs while also continuing to address legal problems that they've been dealing with for years. How might they cut costs, David?
Well, there's always that big question about layoffs, and they gave no specifics during the conference call or any of their announcements this week. But he does say we need to do this. And, you know, he's the third CEO in recent years. There's still this big cloud hanging over Wells Fargo for these problems with the sales practices in which they did things like give people products they didn't need and overcharge people. And so he's under the gun now to try and make things right with everybody, with shareholders, with the employees, and with the customers as well.
And Charlotte is their biggest location, right?
It's their East Coast headquarters, right?
As you reported, this announcement of declining profits came on the same day that J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup reported strong results for the fourth quarter. Is this just a problem at Wells? Because I think Bank of America also reported.
Well, to be clear, the legal issues are part of Wells' problem, and they did take a $1.5 billion charge. But the other issue is falling interest rates have really squeezed bank margins and hurt their profits. And that's what also hurt Bank of America. It's a company that's really dependent on interest rates, and they can have big swings there. So we saw Bank of America's profits go down a bit. However, unlike Wells, they did meet analysts' expectations. And so Wall Street was not unhappy with the results. And as Brian Moynihan, the CEO of Bank of America, said during their conference call, the bank is continuing to grow and they're investing in talent, and he sees a good future ahead.
And although BB&T and SunTrust have merged, they're still doing business as individual banks while the merger proceeds, but they unveiled their new logo this week for Truist. That's the name of the new bank, Truist. It looks like, it's hard to describe, but it looks like two T's lying on their side inside a box. But then if you look again, it might be an upright T on top of an upside-down T. It's very Escher.
It's an optical illusion,
yes,
Mike?
Yes. Why that logo? Did they explain it?
So actually, these two banks are, I wouldn't call these the flashiest banks in the world, and they're coming together, and I think this logo is a fairly conservative, bright color purple, I will say. That's kind of interesting about it, but I think it's an attempt to capture the legacy of the two banks and the way that they've approached things, and you know, it's very straightforward. There's, you know, Bank of America's logo, for example, it's got that interesting red, white, and blue with the flag field. Wells Fargo invokes the history through their typeface in theirs. This one is very straightforward, and I look forward to seeing what sort of marketing they're going to put around this.
So it's they told The Observer that it's supposed to be the purple colors, a mix of BB&T Burgundy and SunTrust Blue, and so it's the merger of those color palettes to get Truist Purple, and that the two T's inside the square stand for touch and technology, while the square is meant to symbolize trust. That's from a company presentation on the logo.
Wow.
Don't you feel better now, Mike,
Actually, I like it. I like the logo. All right, the North Carolina primary is looming large. I think the date's March 3rd. We have a contest for U.S. Senate on that ballot. It's not just about Democratic presidential nominees or contestants. Senator Tom Tillis has proposed holding five televised debates with the Democratic nominee heading into November's general election. Tillis is one of three Republicans running in the primary. Does this indicate his confidence in winning that primary?
Oh, he's pretty confident that he will. It's interesting, though. Tillis started out in North Carolina, which is kind of a battleground state, having a little daylight between himself and the president, President Trump. But since then, he has totally tethered himself to Trump. And you see all of his releases and on from impeachment to the trade deal that was passed. He is very much in the corner of Trump, and he has taken on the rhetoric of attacking possible Democratic opponents as being radical. And so we'll see if that works out for him. But Cal Cunningham, who is the leader so far in the Democratic primary as far as funds and numbers, though we don't know, of course, until the primary, has said, bring it on. He's willing to debate him. But it will be an interesting test of Trumpism. Will it work in North Carolina?
And Tillis has been described by national pundits as among the most vulnerable GOP senators up for re-election, and yet he says, quote, it's critical that voters have numerous opportunities to hear directly from the candidates. Well, I salute him for that, because if he's vulnerable, you would think he would want to stay away from
it. He might duck it, yeah.
And also, this coming impeachment trial in the Senate will be a chance for him, too, to basically say where he stands, which I think we know where he stands.
Okay. Speaking of impeachment, and they'll talk a lot about this in the next hour, but the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, came into the Senate yesterday, took the oath for the trial, and then swore in all 100 senators for a trial that begins Tuesday at 1 p.m. There's still a lot of questions about procedure to be answered, including whether or not there'll be witnesses. Polls indicate that most Americans, including most Republican Americans, want witnesses. But Trump's approval ratings among Republicans remain high, and I don't think he does anymore. Which will have more influence, do you think, Mary?
Well, I think that people are in their partisan camps, and it's true. And even though the senators had to pledge to John Roberts that they would be jurors, many of them have already said they've made up their minds. They don't want to hear any more evidence, and they definitely won't vote. And I think we can pretty much say that you won't have 2/3 of senators voting to impeach the president.
How can you make up your mind and then pledge to be impartial
well,
an oath to God.
You will have to ask these. I think if you had a regular jury and you were being voir dired and said you really had made your mind up, you would not be approved for that jury. That said,
jury is set by the Constitution.
Yes. But Speaker of the House Pelosi, people were saying, what was her strategy holding off delivering the articles of impeachment? But one thing that has happened is, in the meantime, so many other things have come up.
Do you think they knew that Bolton and Lev Parnas, who has come to the New York Times and MSNBC and said that Trump knew everything and they all knew everything, including Pence and Bolton and Barr, they all knew everything. Do you think that they knew in the House that that was going to be coming down the pike, and so they held it until now?
I'm not sure they knew that these exact things would come up, but this unpredictable president and presidency, I think they knew that the longer they waited, something was going to happen. And it becomes harder and harder for them to say they don't want to see any witnesses or hear from any witnesses. You're basically saying, I don't want the information.
Right. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist and a contributor to Roll Call and WCCB TV. Joe Bruno's with us today from WSSC TV. Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer. And David Borax, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.